I'm dreaming of Harry's.
It's time to get up, Scott, and shave that beard.
You know, Harry's replacement blades. I want to talk about that for a minute because not only are they great blades, but they're inexpensive. Less than $2 for each replacement blade. I just did a Google search on Amazon search, and other blades, 50% more. 50%, Don.
And just ask 10 million people. Is that how many, Scott?
10 million people have tried Harry's.
And that's a lot of people. That's a lot of whiskers.
You can get your own trial set. It's a $13 value by going to harrys.com/TRN. This is what you get, Freeman. You get a weighted ergonomic handle. You get a 5-blade razor with lubricating strip and that trimmer blade, which I have fallen in love with. The rich lather shave gel and a travel blade cover.
And Scott, if you're not completely satisfied, over the moon about your shave, they'll totally refund. That's Harry's. Will totally refund your purchase.
Go to harrys.com/TRN. Pathprojects.com. I want to focus on their new color of short sleeve shirt. It's a cascade short sleeve. It's now available in navy. They now have 5 colors. They have white, gray, black, the olive color, and now the navy.
That's nice. I love those colors. And I want to tell you a story about my gray short sleeve Path Project shirt.
Yeah.
I was out paddle boarding and I put on a shirt because I'm UV conscious. I want to make sure that I'm not coming out red when I'm done. But it was pretty warm out there and I put it on top of my board. And as I was coming back off the shore, I placed this t-shirt on a rock, a big flat rock right by the parking area.
Yeah.
And I drove away and I realized after I got home, I forgot my shirt. I spent 15 minutes driving back to that rock because this shirt's important to me. I love this shirt.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get there and I'm bummed out because it's gone. And I think, well, obviously,
somebody stole your shirt.
You leave something valuable like a Rolex watch on a rock out by the lake, somebody's going to pick it up, right?
Yeah.
And so 2 days later, it's time for another workout. And I go to the same spot and that shirt is on the shore sitting there waiting for me like a loyal shirt would do.
You know what? Path Projects gear is not just for running. It's for paddle boarding, and it's valuable wear.
It's for going to the store. It's for going to sleep. It's for everything you can imagine. You know, didn't you used to say, Scott, you're a never nude?
I didn't say that.
You didn't say that? Well, I think you did. And you would definitely be a never nude if you had Path Projects because you'd never want to take it off.
It feels like I am nude. Get yours at pathprojects.com, or you can go to our partners page, click on the Path Projects banner, and get you some.
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Oh, come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And I am Scott Warren. Who do we have on the line today?
We have Iron Mike Wardian, and he is he's a living legend, really, in my mind, for a lot of reasons. You're about to tell us why, Scott.
This is only an hour podcast, so we're going to do a Reader's Digest biography of Mike Wardian. But some of the things that you ought to know, you've seen him run, you've seen some of his results. But did you know, Don, that he won the U.S. 50K championships 3 times, won the U.S. 50-mile championship, and also won the U.S. national 100K championship? He can run all the distances.
I know he stood on top of that podium plenty of times, but some of the things that impressed me most is, I remember, Mike, you came out and you ran the North Face Challenge out here in San Francisco. And then the very next day, you run the CIM Marathon here in Sacramento without missing a beat, and you have stellar performances in both of the events. And to me, that's amazing. So welcome to the podcast, Mike Wardian.
Thank you very much, guys. It's awesome to be on. You guys are one of my favorite listens, so it's cool to be a part of it.
Right on. We thank you for that.
You know, and the thing that's crazy about Mike, and Mike, you're going to have to explain yourself.
Yes.
That That's what we're doing on this podcast is clearing the air.
You got some explaining to do.
There's a lot of weird records you have, but one of the things along with the North Face and the San Francisco thing is back in 2012, he ran in the U.S. Olympic trials in Houston, a 2 hour 21 minute marathon at the Olympic trials. And then the very next morning he gets up and runs the Houston marathon in 2 hours and 31 minutes.
Yeah, some explaining, but there's also a record in there, Scott, about pushing a baby carriage.
baby stroller.
Yeah, what's up with that, Mike? Since we're getting stuff out here, let's just dive right into that.
You couldn't find a babysitter? What's up?
I've done a lot of those type of challenges, I guess. And the one with the jog stroller was with my son, Pierce. It's funny, he's almost 13 now, so it's been a few years since I pushed him in the jog stroller. But yeah, that was one of the coolest things that I was able to do. Was I saw that maybe 2 or 3 years before we had kids, and I asked my wife. She actually wasn't even my wife at the time. I said, like, hey, if we ever have kids, it would be awesome to try to, you know, set this record. And she was kind of like, yeah, whatever. And then, 3 or 4 years later, I was like, hey, remember when I asked you about that thing? And so, I was able to run a marathon with Pierce I think it was 2007, actually. I ran 2 hours, 42 minutes pushing him in the jog stroller with, like, the biggest part of that was all the auxiliary stuff in case something happened. So I had like extra diapers and wipes. And at that time it was like a flip phone in the back. And of course my brother called me in the middle of it to see what I was doing. And I was like, dude, I'm trying to set a world record. Why are you calling me? I said not to call me. And of course it woke Pierce up. It was a whole thing, but it turned out great. And then I actually did it again with our younger son, Grant, and I lost. I ran 2 hours and I think 34 minutes or 33 minutes, and another guy ran 2:31. And we finished first and second in the Route 66 marathon in Tulsa. So it was pretty awesome to get to do it not just once but twice and to run pretty fast times, pushing a jog stroller.
So what's the best jog stroller to purchase? I mean, I see a lot of them out there. Is there one that's preferred by you racing athletes that are pushing strollers?
When I was doing it, I used the Bob. I used the Bob Revolution just because I liked the way the wheels were on that. The Ironman was also pretty good, but the Revolution, like when you actually got somewhere, you could unlock the wheel. A lot of people now supposedly like the Thule. It's funny, I was actually having a conversation yesterday about that with my brother because he still has some younger kids. And he was talking about, which strollers are good now, because I was like, I don't see a lot of the strollers that I used to see. But I know a lot of people still use Bob because he was saying that is like in his peer group that a lot of people are still using Bob. And then I've heard the Thule is really good. And I think there's one called the Chariot that's pretty good. That's pretty good. And then I saw the Thule, that make like the bike racks and mm-hmm. stuff. I think they have a stroller that's pretty good.
Hey, I got a question. Do your boys get a finisher's medal?
Huh. They did. Well, they actually beat me across the line. Right? Okay. So I think that they were like, you actually weren't second in that race in Tulsa. You were fourth, but whatever.
Hey, you've been in a lot of different events, but one that's completely unique was just a week or so ago, and we had a chance to get to see you out here at the Hoka One One 100K Challenge out here that they featured some of their finest athletes and their brand new Carbon X shoe. And so we got a chance to see you there. I've got a few questions about that. Number one, they kept it secret. I mean, very secret. When did you learn about it? Because we only learned about it for, a week or so before it happened when they started to promote it. When was your introduction to this race? Because they've got to tell their athletes.
No, not really, man. They're just like, we always have to be on call. That's just a part of our agreement. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, okay.
Like, no, they told, they, I, I'm joking. They told us probably, I had actually heard about like a rumor about it probably about a year before it happened. And I wasn't sure when it was going to happen or if it was going to happen. And then it was kind of firmed up at the beginning of the year. And then I knew for sure that it was going to happen, like the dates and everything, around the middle of March. So I had about 2 months. I was actually running across Israel when I found out for sure. which was like one of the coolest things I've done this year when I set the FKT, running like 1,000 kilometers, or 1,931 miles across Israel, like in 10 days. That's when I got the email, and I was like, okay, I'll just deal with this when I get back. But I was really excited about it, 'cause it was, you know, it's a chance to be part of history. So I knew it would be a super special event. And I was really excited also to try out the shoes, 'cause I'd heard so much about them, and I'd just gotten a pair when I got back. So I got a couple of weeks to run in them before I got to like do the event.
You know, Mike, do you need any forewarning about a race? It seems like as much as you race that you just kind of willy-nilly, you know, you're in San Francisco or running the North Face and you decide, you know what, I'm going to run over here to Sacramento. They have a race on Saturday. I'm going to run the marathon in Sacramento. I'm already here. My flight doesn't leave for another 3 hours and I can run a marathon faster than that.
Yeah. I mean, if I can, you know, be efficient with my time, especially, you know, with a family, like if I can do multiple events at the same time, I always try to take advantage of that. It's like you said, I'm out in Austin for a Spartan trail run. It's not until Sunday and there's a race tomorrow. So I was like, hey, sweet. It's Saturday's open. So, you know, maybe I can jump in that too. So definitely like to take advantage of the opportunities when they present themselves.
So with that kind of fly by the seat of your pants, running multiple races a week and sometimes back to back, I mean, you're an elite athlete. You're used to being on the podium. Do you go into all of these thinking, I'm on a podium, I'm gonna win this race, or are you just doing them, some of them for training and focus on one or two a year to go out and all out win it?
No, I mean, I definitely try to be as competitive as I can be. Like, I know tomorrow in the Spartan, it's like the elite wave. Like, there's guys that they do this full time, and I don't have a lot of the skills yet. So I'm definitely not expecting to win. Just want to, you know, take part in it and learn more about the culture and be out on the course and just be a part of it. But yeah, most of the time, if I'm lining up somewhere, I want to try to, you know, throw my neck out there and see what happens. And so, I definitely try to like build this, like the way that we're talking, it sounds like, you know, I don't really have any, plan, but there is kind of like a strategy most of the time. Like the races all kind of build towards something. Like earlier this year, like I did the Hurt 100 miler. And then right after that, I did 10 marathons in 10 days and set the world record for doing that, and seven of those were on seven different continents. But then that built to the 10 days of going across Israel, you know? So like I use that kind of experience of doing 10 marathons in 10 days to be able to do 63 miles a day, basically. And so like just to have a feel for like what my body would feel like when you're kind of pushing yourself in that kind of capacity and those kind of distances. Like I didn't know if I could double what I was doing in the marathons, but I kind of wanted to see like, how does my body feel like being pushed for 10 days? And so like, it looks like, oh, you just kind of do one after the other. And right now I'm just kind of taking a little, downtime. So, you know, before I have like a race called Man vs. Horse, but, that's going to be like, a race in 2 weeks or so in the UK and Wales, where it's 22 miles with 5,000 feet of elevation gain, which is almost kind of mimicking what I'm going to do this weekend. So, you know, it is logical in what I'm doing. It's just, I just do a lot more than most people.
How is it, you know, the obvious next question is, and I'm glad Scott gave it to me, How are you able to recover in between these races or events? There's a lot of us that need to take as much time recovering as we did tapering.
6 months.
Well, not quite six, but
and a vacation in Hawaii.
Yeah. How is it your? Do you have a secret sauce, a secret recipe, or are you just genetically fortunate? What do you think?
I think some of it's just the willingness to want to go back out there and do it again. I think a lot of people put a lot of focus and energy on a certain event, and then when it's over, like, it's hard to kind of get that dedication and focus back, and they need a break, and I completely understand that. Like, I think one of my special talents is that I'm like, as soon as I do something, I'm like, okay, that was cool, and then I look for the next thing. And I think that kind of mentality allows you to kind of just jump back into training and have the dedication and the desire to be out there kind of pushing yourself to do it again. And I think that helps with the recovery. And then also I try to stay moving after the event. So I think that's really important. So try to do active recovery. So that's like, light running, jogging, cycling, and then try to stay really hydrated afterwards also. Huh. And then get in some good calories, and then I try to get back to training as quick as I can. Like, I'd say the longest break I've taken is about 3 or 4 days, and that was actually after the 100K, the Hoka One One 100K that we just did, and it was just because I've already raced like 1100 miles this year, which is as many miles as I did in 53 events in 2018. And so my body was just like, hey, you need to give me a little break. And so I think also just kind of listening to like the cues, and I used to like say that I did that, and then I actually didn't do that. And I think I'm doing a really much better job of kind of being mindful to those cues now and staying tuned into like what my body's trying to tell me.
Yeah, Mike, do you just have a bib on all of your shirts? It's permanently tattooed on there. It's like that. Here's my number. I use it at every race.
Yeah, I just have a barcode.
Yeah.
It's actually like in South Africa, like they make you buy your chip and you use it for all the races. That would actually not be a bad thing to incorporate here, I think. So, yeah, no, I definitely have a lot of safety pins and a lot of bibs for sure.
I think you've already answered this, but I'm still a little dumbfounded, and I want to dive a little bit deeper. So, as much as you race, usually almost every weekend, when you get back home on Monday, are you going out and training? So do you do training miles during the week, or is the week the recovery where you're resting, like you were saying, light recovery? I can't imagine you putting in, the 80, 70, 80, 90, 100 mile weeks and going and racing and then coming back and doing a 70, 80, 90 mile an hour week.
Yeah, it depends. So like this year it's been, some big events that have taken a little bit of time, like the thing in Israel, it took 10 days, and then the 10 marathons in 10 days took, 10 days also. And, get my leg speed back. And so that means going to the track and doing, 5Ks, 10Ks. And that's one of the cool things about, doing this stuff with Spartan. Like the last weekend I did a Spartan sprint race, which was like 3 miles, but, also kind of like obstacles and like getting it stronger, but, also kind of building up that speed. And so like getting back on the track, I think, has been important. So like I am trying to get back into training, but yeah, it's not all like, if you're doing like two events, sometimes it doesn't make sense to do like a track workout. But I think for me to get faster, I need to do those kind of track workouts. So like I am starting to incorporate those back into my training.
If you're listening
Does
to this,
that make sense?
Yeah. If you're listening to this podcast and you aren't following Mike on his social media, you need to, because I'm impressed with all of the little videos that you post during the week of the cross training you do, the core workout. I think I've seen a ton of videos with a medicine ball that you're playing around with. How important is that?
One of my favorites, dude. Yeah. I mean, I think I've been really lucky. I got involved with a guy named Jesse Fuller, and he's also a trail runner, and he's actually doing the Mountain Master, or the what is it? It's the Virginia Happy Trails MMT race this weekend. It's a 100-miler. And he's a personal trainer, but he's incredible with coming up with like fun, exciting, and challenging workouts. And so like I've been trying to share those with people just because I've noticed a big difference in how much stronger it's made me and how much more endurance I have, and just like made me more pliable and flexible and increased my mobility. And that's something like I wasn't as concerned with before, and I think has made a big difference and allowed me to do even more. So I think that a lot of us get locked in on just running, and especially once, you know, if we find trail running and we're like, wow, you know, that's all we want to do. But I think like actually going to the gym and doing some of this stuff can be really beneficial and really help your running. And so I want to make sure that, you know, I'm doing it, and then hopefully, you know, people are finding it interesting and it's something that they can incorporate too.
You say beneficial and helps your running. I'd like to break that down just a little bit if we can. So you're out there running without any cross train at all. Just say you are not doing any. And then you start incorporating it. Can you kind of compare and contrast how you feel in the Mike body that runs only compared to the Mike body that has this cross training jam going?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, I've actually become a lot more agile, I think, on the trail, and a lot stronger in like positions that are like prone. So like single leg stuff, dodging obstacles. And then especially I noticed it in the longer races. So like anything over like 2 or 3 hours. Wait, hold on. Oh. Sorry, God. That's something that I've noticed a lot of.
So did you, obviously kind of sounds like you just started to do a little bit more of the cross training and gym workout. When you were younger, did you do much cross training?
I did when I was playing lacrosse, but then I stopped doing it. When I got into running as much. And so I just picked it up maybe 2.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed a huge difference. Like it's made, like, I don't know if I could have been, if I would have been able to do the run across Israel or the 10 marathons in 10 days had I not done it. I think just for being able to bounce back and just to be like physically stronger has made a huge difference, and allowed me to just maintain form. It's like stuff that you don't ever think about. Mm-hmm. But when you're pumping up a 3,000 or 4,000 foot climb and you've been doing it on day 8 and you still feel as strong as you did, and you're able to run like 5 or 6 minute miles on the downhill after you've been running tonight, like, I don't think I would have been able to do that had I not done the training.
Yeah, I think running is a overall full body workout, not just legs and hips and glutes and calves, but your entire body propels you. So having a fit body makes good sense, especially in those long events when you start to wear out and get in fatigue some of those big movers below your waist.
Well, and actually, I think the other thing that I didn't expect to be such a big benefit that I've noticed though is when you're carrying a sack, especially if you're doing a race that has a lot of mandatory kit like a UTMB or Hard Rock doesn't have mandatory kit, but if you don't bring stuff, you're going to die, basically. So you need to have stuff. And I've just noticed, like, a lot of the fatigue that I used to get on my shoulders and my back used to get a little bit sore from having to carry all that stuff. I just don't get that anymore. And I don't even notice the sack, which is a nice feeling. And especially if you're using poles to be able to have strength to be able to power up the hills, is a huge benefit, I think.
You know, let's talk about poles. We've been using trekking poles in our training a little bit over the last year and a half.
Nice. Which ones do you guys use?
A Lakey, of course. How about you?
I just got some. One of my sponsors is Raylight. They have some nice ones too. But before that, I was using the Black Diamond. So I was just wondering which ones you guys were using.
Yeah. So, do you like using them? Do you think that there's an advantage? Would you like to use them at races that don't allow them?
I think they're incredible. Yeah. I mean, I started using them to get ready for UTMB maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And then I use them every time that they're legal. And I think that they're a big difference maker for sure, especially if you know how to use them. And I never like tuck them away. So I just carry, and I use them across the entire length of Israel. And even if it's flat, I just kind of carry them, and they never really bother me. And I just feel like it's just like carrying a water bottle or a handheld or something. But if you can use them and use them effectively, I think they're a great tool. And if a race doesn't allow them, then I just feel like that's just like part of the deal, and I don't really stress about it.
I wonder, go ahead, Mike.
I was just saying, like, and there's some races where you have, like, you can't like pick up and drop them, like UTMB. Like, if you start with the race with them, you have to finish the race with them. And I think that's cool too. It's just like, whatever the rules are, it's fine. Just as long as you know.
I wonder, in the races that don't allow them, if you could pick up a stick and start using that as a, you know, what that? You find a bamboo stick, something light?
Maybe there's a carbon fiber stick laying along the trail there that's painted bright orange.
It says Lakey on the side? Yeah, that's it. I just found it.
It's funny. I've actually seen that. So I've seen that more than once where people have picked up a stick and used it in that capacity. Actually, Jimmy Olsen did when we were running in Costa Rica. He twisted his ankle so bad, I caught up with him, and I was like, oh, my God, are you okay? And he looked like, you know, he had a cane, basically. But he had two sticks, like you're talking about.
Hey, you mentioned your sponsor. What is it, Radlight?
Raid Light.
Yeah.
They're like a French company. I don't know if you guys know them or not, but they make all kinds of stuff, but their poles are really nice.
Yeah, I had a chance to go to Europe and run Tour de Jeanne, and they Raylight was over there, and they've got some great gear. I mean, I drooled over a lot of their stuff, their packs, you know, their poles, and a lot of their equipment seems top notch. But we don't have it around here much, and I don't know if they're, you know, spreading the word or trying to enter the market. But they're a fantastic quality. And the price seems to be pretty attractive.
Yeah, it's weird. The first time I saw them was at a race called Marathon de Sable, and a lot of the people had their backpacks. But yeah, they make really top-notch stuff. They also have some really nice rain kit. It's super lightweight, but really protective. What I'm working with them in is on their poles, and they do have a little presence here in the U.S. They have a U.S. distributor, but it's not as big as it could be for sure.
Yeah, well, I think they're probably growing, and I think their materials are certainly worth taking a look at. Now, go ahead, Scott.
I agree.
Hey, I was going to ask you, I knew absolutely nothing about this Israel run. Tell us a little bit about that and start out. How do you come up with something like this? I mean, there's a lot of interesting things that you do. Are you the creative mastermind behind this, or do you have people you know, texting you and saying, hey, Mike, I think that you should run a 50K on your hands and knees backwards. How do you come up with these ideas?
I actually do have that, and I love it. So all the people that have ideas, please keep sending them to me. This idea was created by a guy named Zoli Bahari. He owns a company called Canaan Running, which is a running adventure company based in Israel. And I randomly met him at a race called the Coastal Challenge, the one I was just telling you about with Timmy Olsen. And he was running it, and I was running it. And he was, as people do, you know, talking about the amazing trails. You know, everyone's home trails are the best trails that, you know, you've ever seen, right?
Sure,
and
yeah.
You're like, oh, sure they are, you know, come on, really? And he said, no, really, like the trails in Israel are, oh, we'll take your breath away. And I'm just kind of like, what, you know, I hear that every day. And I'm sure that they're beautiful. And but he was really persistent, and he said, why don't you come and check it out? And I was, you know, as an American, I was a little worried about security and the stuff you see on TV. And so I didn't even know much about Israel as far as like the running scene there or anything other than, you know, it's the Holy Land, and it's got a lot of history. And so I went over and did a race in December of 2018 called the Hyrus Ultra Marathon. And it was a 50 miler in the hills of Jerusalem. And it was amazing. Like, and I had no issues with like, safety. I never really felt any kind of anxiety at all. And I was just like, this place is awesome. And the trails are amazing. And then we actually went down and checked out the Israeli National Trail, because I was like, yeah, I'd give it a shot, because it kind of works into my plans. Like, you know, you're saying, like, how do you plan your schedule? Like, another thing I want to do is run across the country. And I was like, well, if I can run 10 days, 631 miles on the Israeli National Trail, and know that I can handle that kind of volume of, like, 100K a day, then, you know, I could, you know, probably do, like, the Appalachian Trail or run across the country, which are, you know, kind of longer term goals of mine. But I don't have to be gone for that long. So it kind of worked out that way. And then when I went to Israel and just saw how amazing the terrain was, and just traverse in such a small, like, you can get from like one side of Israel to the other in, you know, 5 or 6 hours. And so, like, to have that much traversing in such a small area, you get desert, you get ocean, and you get snow-capped mountains. I was like, yeah, I want to do this. And so that's kind of how it happened.
You know, that's what I was going to ask. I've been to Israel a couple of times, and it's pretty narrow. Did you run back and forth? I mean, it's not 650 miles across.
Yeah. So it's actually, so it's 631 miles. It's from the town of Eilat, so, you know, kind of down in the south, to the very top, which is Kibbutz Dan, which is right on the Syrian border.
Yeah.
And so that's where the mountains are. So people, you can either do it north to south or south to north. And a lot of people do it, a lot of Israeli people do it, like, when they finish with the military, since there's, you know, mandatory service there, and they have some good fitness coming out of the military. So there's a lot of kids on there. Quite a big deal there, and it's something that's really well known. And so I thought it was really cool for me to get a chance to see what it was all about. But I think the coolest part of it was, like, the Israeli running community really rallied around the event and came out and really supported it. So, like, every day, the first couple of days, I didn't have a ton of people, but almost every day I had people. And then by the end, like, the, you know, probably that fifth or sixth day, I probably had groups, like, at any one point, you know, it could be 5 people in it or 25 people. And so that was really cool. It kind of turned into, like, this scumpy type thing.
Yeah, that's cool. And I imagine it brings a lot of energy when some runners just jump in and want to do 20 miles with you or something. It probably gives quite a boost to you personally and, you know, physically.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Mentally and physically, and also just emotionally, just to have people that are,
that are, you know, taking time out of their day. And what was so cool is they became like, they were just random strangers jumping in a car and driving for 2.5 hours to run 10K with me. Like, that doesn't just happen normally, you know, or calling in late to work, or, you know, bringing their kids out on the trail in the middle of the night. It was awesome, man. I mean, the people of Israel are super cool.
Yeah. I think the last we spoke last time, you shared with us that you were a logistics manager for some offshore trade or something. Is that true?
Yeah. So I'm actually a partner now. So I'm a partner in a international ship brokerage. So we deal with primarily humanitarian food aid cargoes, and we represent U.S. and foreign flag ocean going carriers. So we work with big companies like Maersk Line Limited, Sea Lift, a bunch of foreign flag owners. And what we do is we hopefully pair their ships with U.S. agricultural commodities going to places like Ethiopia, Somalia, Syria, West Africa, Central and South America, and, you know, stuff into, like, even Korea and Pakistan and places like that.
So that was really the reason for the question was, how are you able to afford this type of time off? You know, most of us that work down at Home Depot or somewhere, we're supposed to be there at 8 o'clock and we get to leave for lunch. But, you know, you're out there doing things all over the world.
Yeah, it's weird. So today I was up at 4:30 this morning working on offers to get them in by 11 o'clock Eastern time. And that's just the cool thing about the internet, the way it is now. Like, anywhere in the world I can be working. When I'm in the middle of Israel, as long as there's an internet service, then yeah, I can work. And so that's been a real way that it's impossible, but it's definitely a challenge to try and balance that. And then I also like coach, and then I'm still competing a lot. So, you know, just trying to, and then we have kids too. So, trying to get out of the soccer practices and run groups and all that.
you put the kids in the Bob stroller there and get them to soccer practice. Dad, I'm 13. I have to hold my feet up in this thing.
Now they're running with me.
Oh, cool.
Actually running with me. So it's fun, And I'm pretty lucky. I have a great amount of support. So it's. I think you guys know any person that's doing this at any level, there's a lot of people that are making it happen. So I have great sponsors. My wife is insanely cool. She's a saint, and she's the one who kind of makes all this work. And then, the kids, I try to bring them as much as I can, but the ability to share the world with them has been one of the biggest pleasures of being able to do this.
Hey, Mike, we don't, or at least I don't know much about the early years. I know that you played lacrosse in college. Did you run prior to that, or did lacrosse, just training for lacrosse, get you into running? How did that all work?
No, actually, I didn't run at all. I started running my junior year of college when I stopped playing lacrosse just to kind of stay fit. And then I decided that I wanted to run the Boston Marathon, and I figured I'd just run it once. And I decided that because I was at my fraternity brother's house, and his mom, Vicki Boyson, had just finished the Boston Marathon, and she had her little unicorn medal and shiny blanket, and I was like, I want that. And it was the first time that I ever met a person that wasn't like, the only people you see on TV are the guys who look like Bill Rogers by now, right? Uh-huh. 22,000 other regular people that run a marathon. And so I was like, wow, if Vince's mom could run a marathon, I could run a marathon. And that you had to qualify for Boston. Like, I just sent them it was like before the internet. So I sent them like a self-addressed stamped envelope, and they sent me back the pamphlet, and it said like, what's your qualifying marathon? And I was like, what? I don't know about that. And so then I ran Marine Corps because I figured, like, I'm a D.C. native, and figured, like, if something goes really bad, my mom and dad can come get me off the course. And I actually ended up I ran, I think, 306 and qualified for Boston, and then decided that I'd try to break 3 hours because that would make me, like, a, you know, air quotes, like a real man. And ran, I think, 254 and just got hooked. And then from there, I just was like, wow, I want to try to run all big marathons. And so I ran Chicago, Marine Corps, New York, all in like 4 weeks, and got stronger each one. And then I heard about a race called the JFK 50 miler, and I just didn't believe you could run that far. I was just like, that's not true. Like, whoever's telling you that, is that's just a lie. And then I was like, well, and by that time I got my marathon time down to like 235 or 240. And so I was like, man, if you just took my marathon time and double it, I'm going to win that race. And so I went to JFK fully expecting to win. And by like 30 miles, I was walking and getting passed by these old guys. And which, like, they were doing like the Galloway where you like run, walk. And mm-hmm. I was just like, I'm a runner. I'm not going to stop. And they were just crushing me. And I did not win. And I learned very quickly that just because you can run 26 miles doesn't mean that if you double your time, you're going to run that same time for 50 miles. But then I stuck with it and kind of learned and ended up actually winning JFK, I don't know, about 10 years after that. So it's pretty cool, like, just to see, like, if you – I think that's the greatest thing about running is, like, if you're willing to stick with it and put the time and energy into it, it's a very democratic sport in that you're rewarded for that effort. And there's no, like, it doesn't care, like, if you were a runner growing up or not. If you're willing to do the work, then you'll get the results.
I think they go ahead, Scott.
No, I'm just laughing at you. Go ahead.
No, because you weren't going to come up with this one because it's a short comment and you go on to your thing. Okay, Mike, and I'll edit all that out, promise. Not. Okay. No, the run rewards you with a finish, not with necessarily a stellar time, but it just it's very generous with finishes, and I think that's the largest reward that the actual run can give somebody. It's just being a finisher. Go ahead, Scott.
Hey, Mike, I was gonna.
Were you gonna say that, Scott? Were you gonna say my comment?
No, right. Mine's right. Mine's way better. Okay. In fact, I should have butted in.
Okay, let's find out.
Hey, Mike, what is your favorite distance?
Oh, I'll edit that out. Go ahead, Mike.
What is your favorite distance? It seems like you thrive in every distance.
Yeah.
Which distance do you prefer, or is there one?
So yeah, I'd say my favorite distance, like what I normally say is. Or what I used to say is like a marathon, just because it's a distance where it's a distance you can't really hide. Like there's no, you can't fake it through a marathon. You can kind of, you know, bully your way through like a half marathon and get it done, even if you're not maybe in the best fitness. But a marathon, I think it really exposes you, especially after you get to about 18, 19 miles. There's no way you can duck it anymore. Like it's coming for you and you're going to feel it. But as I've gotten, more experience, like I used to like just do 100 milers. Cause I thought like, oh, everyone, you know, you got to do 100 miler. And like, I never saw what the big deal about it was. But then I actually kind of fell in love with that distance. So that's been, really interesting to me, is to see the transformation and just see how much, fulfillment there is in doing 100 miles. And then as I've moved into like some of the longer stuff, I did a 100K called the Ultra Gobi, where it's kind of self-navigation and you're going across the Gobi Desert of China and like just how you're dealing with yourself for that long. And so the longer events have kind of found a niche, but I'd say I get as much pleasure sometimes out of just doing a 5K. So I guess I don't have a great answer for this other than I think that there's value in almost every distance. But I'd say, like, I'm kind of drawn now to marathons. Like, I want to kind of shift my focus there for a little bit. And then also some of the longer stuff, that your body's capable with for a long period of time, and just to see how much you can endure.
Yeah, I would like to. Do you have any other questions, Scott? I don't want to.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Hey, I want to go back to where we started, and that was at the HOKA event. And the start.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, the start was very surreal because I had a chance to get down there to the start, and it was all business. I mean, it was quiet. One side of the street were some of the spectators and the support crew. And the other side of the street were the athletes. They were rolling on foam rollers. They were stretching. They were doing some runs up and down the street to warm themselves up in the early morning. Can you talk about the way that felt as a racer, being unique? There wasn't any music. There wasn't any announcer yapping his jaws or her jaws before the race. It was just business.
Yeah, I thought that was awesome, actually. It was... I think the HOKA ONE ONE 100K world record event was opportunity, right? It was a chance to showcase, like, where you are and like what you want to do, and to try to go for some big goals. And we just had like incredible support, but it was just a group of people all out to see what their limits are, and I think that was awesome. And so they're like, and we're all pros, like we all know, you know, what we're stepping to the line to do. And so I think that there was that kind of peace that comes with, like, okay, we're here to do our job, and we're going to enjoy this as much as we can. But yeah, we want to kind of face that challenge. And it was just serious. And, you know, there was, when you're getting ready to run 100K, like, you know that, especially 100K on the roads where there's no, if you think as a chance to be exposed, like 100K on the roads with nothing but yourself and a time, like, there's no chance to let your foot off the gas. And so, like, I think everyone kind of had that running through their mind, like, hey, this is going to be a thing, and it's going to get hard, and it's going to get hard in a real way, and we're going to have to be ready for that. And I know that, well, I know that's what was going through my head. I don't know what was going through everyone else's head, but I kind of had that feeling where everyone was like, hey, this is going to be real. And the cool thing was that we had such great support. Like, HOKA had, you know, got us pacers, and so we also have that kind of, you don't want to let down the people that have been out there supporting you. And so, like, that was, you know, and that's a big deal. I mean, even if, you know, like, hey, you know, stuff happens, like, you want to do your best, and, you know, you always want to put your best foot forward. And so, like, I know that's what was going through my head, is like, I want to go out there and show them what I'm capable of. And of course it didn't go great for me, actually, but that was okay. I did the best I could on the day.
Oh, it looked like you had a great day out there. And that was my follow-up question, was about the pacers, because, I mean, you had as big of the names that were the eight, I think it was eight of you, elite athletes, you know, going for the record that day. The pacers' names were just as big. Sage Kanade is out there. I mean, there's a lot of guys and gals out there that are pacing. Did you pick your pacers, and what was the pacers' role, and why was it important for them to? That's five questions if you're counting. why was it so important to have a pacer out there for you guys?
Oh man, yeah. So we didn't. I think some of the people picked their pacers. I think I got lucky in that it worked out as, like, who do you think could run your pace for as long as you needed them to, and so. I got really lucky. I ran with a guy named Craig Lutz and another guy named Vincent, and they were just there to take care of you. And so, like, they're there to help, you know, kind of hold you on pace, but also, and then I ran with Patrick Regan for probably the first 30K or so. And he had Chris Brown pacing him, and also, Sage Cannaday. So it was pretty funny. Like when Sage is like, "Hey, do you need some water? Like here, you know." And you're like, "Wow, you're awesome for doing this." So it was really cool. But it was basically just like a fun group run. Until it got really hard, and then I actually had to stop and go to the bathroom, so I dropped off those guys and never saw them until like 25 miles later. I think for me it was nice just having somebody to share the load with and to really kind of be there to kind of just help you navigate that kind of time on your own, because in a regular race you'd have other people maybe around you that you're kind of working with. And in this race, we had so many different people going for different kind of goals that it was nice to have kind of people dedicated to making sure that you were taken care of. And I think Hogan did a really good job kind of mashing up people with different skill levels and different paces during the day.
Well, that was obviously a world-class event. It was fun to. I was overseas and got to do what our listeners do and listen to the podcast and watch the simulcast that they did.
Cool! Nice. Yeah, my parents watched it, and like a bunch of my friends watched. They said it was really well done.
The coverage was the best I've seen of a race, besides marathons and Tour de France.
Yeah, it was exactly like Tour de France. They had a full stage set up with lighting and everything for the announcers. And then they had motorcycles with guys backwards with cameras and a smart vehicle with a cameraman on it following you guys around, or you were following them around, to be more accurate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was quite a production, man. I got to see it kind of come together, and they really brought in experts that knew what they were doing. And I think it really showed. I mean, they did it right. And I mean, that's the kind of like thing that I think is cool to see, like a company that didn't have to do that. You know, that's something, you know, they could have said, "Hey, just go to a race that's already established." And, yeah, you know, that would be cool. But like, we want to make this into our thing, and this is part of our heritage, ultra running. And so we're going to kind of showcase, you know, what incredible athletes, which is a lot of, as you know, like you don't get a lot of, mainstream ultra marathon coverage, and so this is an opportunity to kind of showcase that what we do, you know, is valid and is something that deserves to be shown and seen, and that people appreciate that.
Hey, Mike, I'm gonna change subjects a little bit because I'm curious about another thing. You are a vegetarian. I'm wondering if the chicken came before the egg. Were you a vegetarian before you were a runner, or after, and did you do it to help your running, and does it? That was four
Actually,
questions.
Was that five more questions?
Yep. Just pick the ones that you feel like answering.
that's cool. Like, no, so I stopped eating red meat in high school, and then I got salmonella poisoning in college, and so I stopped eating chicken, I think my sophomore year of college, so like 1993 or 94, and then from there, I think I decided like, hey, I could probably go without finish, and then each time I kind of took in general, had more energy, and I just didn't understand it, because growing up at that time, in the 90s, at least around the culture I was in with lacrosse, it was like, you got to eat your meat to get your protein, to be able to be strong, to, be an athlete. And, I don't know why, I just started experimenting on myself and was like, hey, I wonder what would happen if I did this. And so that was kind of around the time that I found running. So I wouldn't say one came before the other, but I think it was just like an evolution where I was like, hey, I wonder if I do this, what would happen? And then I noticed that my running became easier, and I also just felt better. And you know, that's just for me. Like, I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, you gotta do it for you. I feel like people have to find what works for them. But for me, that worked out really well. And I do feel like it helped me be able to recover and to be able to have the energy I need to do what I want to do.
And I have a final question as we're wrapping up here. And as you may or may not know, we're good friends with the NorCal Ultras, Julie Fingar, who helped put on that Hoka challenge out there, the 100K. And she told
me... Yeah, she's awesome, man. She's so cool. I got to meet her at when we dropped off our water bottle. I loved it. And I've been wanting to do some of those races that she puts on, and I just haven't been able to get out there. So it was just an honor to meet her because she's been part of our sport for so long.
Yeah, she has. And she's a great race director, and she's passionate about the sport and really loves all the runners from the front to the back, and she makes them all feel special at any of her events. And so, quick plug for Julie's races. Yeah, go out and do some of those, because the swag's great and the trail's great and the volunteers are fantastic, yeah. And it's a lot of fun. But here's my question, Mike. She said you have a bag called the Apocalypse Bag.
What?
That's right.
What?
I need you to hip us to what the Apocalypse Bag is all about.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. I think I forgot to get that back from her, as you know, I've done like a million races, and so I've had almost every single thing go wrong that could possibly go wrong. I've had, chronic diarrhea. I've had chafing that's, been blood down, from under my underarms all the way to, my ankles, and... I've been sick to my stomach. I've gotten stung on my face before. And so, the Apocalypse Bag is basically, everything that can go wrong is just in this little bag. And, it's got, a space blanket in it. It's got, squirrel's nut butter. It's got Imodium. It's got Pepto-Bismo. It's got ginger chews. It's got... tape, it's got blister shield, it's got scissors, I don't know, yeah, it's just basically if everything goes bad, go to the Apocalypse Bag and get yourself out and see if you can salvage your day. And so yeah, that's basically what it is.
So do you show...
But it was funny because she's like, hey, do you want to put your name on that? And I was like, I'm just gonna call it the Apocalypse Bag.
That's awesome.
That's good. So now we all know about the Apocalypse Bag. And if you're running a race with Mike in it and your world falls apart, check the aid station. See if he has this Apocalypse Bag there, because there's probably something in there to pull you out of your jam.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's the stuff that you're supposed to do, but there's some ibuprofen in there, some Advil, some, Tylenol, some, I've had it where do you guys know the drug Cipro? It's like napalm for your stomach. During Marathon de Sable, I was like, I don't know if you guys ever saw that, but I finished third there, which was super high. Nobody really ever does that well from that part of the world. And so I was really excited, but I got this really bad stomach flu, because one of the things that happens at race like that, where it's a stage race and everyone's together for a week, is, if someone gets sick, everyone kind of gets sick. And so, Cipro basically, destroys all the bacteria in your body. But one of the consequences is it makes your tendons really weak. And so, it's basically am I going to be able to finish the race, or am I going to maybe tear my Achilles tendon? And so, you have to, those are kind of things, you don't want to ever have to make that decision, but, sometimes you got to decide. And so, I took the Cipro because I was I can't get through the race without it. And so, that's the kind of stuff where you're that's in the Apocalypse Bag.
So a warning to all runners that reach into Michael's Apocalypse Bag, you never know what you might find in there or you're taking, and it might be mislabeled. He might have things mixed up that only he knows about. So caution when you're reaching in that Apocalypse Bag.
The only thing is that's the other thing too, is as a, an elite, and drug testing. Like, because I don't know if you, like, even in the HOKA event, they had drug testing. It's like, that's the other thing, is like, you got to make sure that everything that you maybe have in the apocalypse bag is approved. So, and you got to know what the consequences are. So, like, I definitely don't have anything in there that it would get me into trouble. Like, even like, if you have like a cold or something like that, you can't take certain stuff. So you just got to be super careful about what you're using.
When you mentioned Sipporo, I think that's how it's pronounced. It reminds me of the ultra running meme that was out there some time ago. I think it was on Twitter or Instagram, and it had a guy taking, and it was an animation, but it just kind of a cartoon type thing. And he was taking some ibuprofen or Motrin or something. And he said, at the point in the race where your kidneys just don't matter anymore, you don't even care. I don't need kidneys. I have two of them. I got to get through this race.
I need a finish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I try never to keep that stuff, but it's nice to have it there in case things are in bad straits. But I mean, for the most part, it's the type of stuff where it's like, if you have it and you don't need it, that's exactly why you have it, right? So like, it's like having insurance. Like, hopefully you never need it.
Yeah. Hey, Mike. You've already run, I think you said, 1,100 miles this year. You're out at the Spartan Trail Race this weekend. What is the one event that you're really looking forward to this year?
And it's May for those that might be keeping track.
So everything I've done so far has been incredible. I think there's a couple events that I'm really looking forward to that I haven't ever done before. A race in 2 weeks I'll be doing called Man vs. Horse. It's in Wales, where it's 650 runners versus 60 horses. And first person to win wins. Like, so most of the time the horses win. I think only maybe two or three times the runners have won. But it's like all great races. It started in a pub between two guys saying like, dude, I think I can outrun your horse. And the dude's like, no way, my horse will outrun you. And then 40 years later, people are still doing the race. It's kind of like the Falmouth Road race. You know, they're trying to get from one bar to the other before closing time or something. So so I'm really looking forward to that. I've been wanting to do that race for probably 10 years, and I'm always silly. Like, I always forget to sign up for it. So this year I actually signed up kind of on time and got on the wait list, and then actually got churned through the wait list and was able to get a spot. So that was actually awesome. And then I'm doing the Broken Arrow Sky Race. So out in Tahoe, so kind of out your guys' way, I think. And yes, that's a race that's been on my radar for a while, but I haven't got a chance to do yet. So that'll be really cool. And then a race called Hood to Coast. I don't know if you guys have done that before.
That's part of the Regnar series.
What is it?
A part of the Regnar series, Hood to Coast?
I don't think so.
I don't know. I don't think it is now. I think Regnar is similar, but I think Hood to Coast is its own thing.
Okay. Strike that.
But yeah. I mean, it's the same concept. So I'm trying to decide if they want me to do like an ultra team or I'm just going to be on a regular team. But yeah, I think that'll be really cool. That's kind of been on my bucket list for a while. And then maybe a race called the Rut, which is in Montana. And then trying to get my sub 219 in the Olympic trial. So maybe go to Berlin or try to go to Chicago or both, and get a fast time. And then I don't know if you guys saw, but the Marine Corps Marathon has a 50K this year. So I'm really excited about trying to do a 50K on the Marine Corps course and try to, you know, get a win there. I've been trying to win that silly marathon forever, and maybe I'll have a chance of 50K.
Well, Dr. Mark Cucasello is usually out there. You guys should hook up and maybe you guys already know one another, but he's a fantastic trail runner and road runner himself, and a big presence here on Trail Runner Nation. So that would be cool to see you two.
Oh,
hook
dude,
up.
Yeah. No, Mark and I are super buddies. Dude, he came out when, I don't know if you guys saw last year, I set the fastest known time on the CNO Canal. So it was like 300 kilometers, like 184 miles. And I ran it in 36 hours and broke a record from like the 70s. But Mark came out and ran with me for like 4.5, 5 hours in the middle of the night in like a wig and like blaring AC/DC.
You know what? I did see a photo somewhere on social media with him wearing that wig. That's right. I forgot all about that.
I should assume that you guys were hooked up. He's a good guy.
Oh, dude, he's my buddy, man. I love that guy. He's got a really cool store out there in like Shepherdstown. I think it's like Two Rivers Treads. Yeah,
yep.
Two Rivers Treads. Yeah, those guys are awesome, man.
Well, Mike, we appreciate you spending some time with us, and you could have run a near marathon during this podcast.
He was.
Oh, that's right.
Maybe when I listen to it, I will be.
That could be. We look forward to seeing you either at Broken Arrow or somewhere. I think anybody that's within earshot of this podcast has a chance of seeing you because you run all over the world.
Yeah.
And it's always great to catch up. And one of the nice things about Mike, he's not only a fantastic runner, but he's a great ambassador for the sport. And when you see him, it feels like, you know, he's happy to see you. He's one of those guys that's very personable and a warm personality, and we're lucky to have him join this sport and not stick around with lacrosse the whole time because we win, and we sure enjoy having you part of the community.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. And thanks for doing what you do. It's nice to have people out there that are really passionate about our sport too and sharing people's stories, so thanks.
Yeah. Hey, good luck at the race tomorrow.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys.
All right, go out and run.
Mas.
All right. Hey, thanks, Mike. Right. That was a lot of fun. We'll get this out today. It's today's podcast.
Oh, cool, man. All right, thanks, guys.
All right. Okay, thanks,
see
Mike.
Ya.
We'll see ya.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.